Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the privilege of interviewing Chelsea Shields Strayer. Is it Strayer or Strayer?
Strayer.
Strayer. Okay, thank you. Chelsea is a biological and cultural anthropologist who specializes in research on the health effects of social belonging, specifically the beneficial and adverse consequences of religion and ritual. She's currently completing her dissertation on the social life of placebos, based on over a decade of fieldwork in the Asante region of Ghana, West Africa, which explains why our bodies evolved to be susceptible to social interactions. Chelsea is also the mother of an adorable 4-year-old daughter and currently works as an adjunct professor, freelance consultant, and TED fellow. She comes from a long line of pioneer ancestors and religious educators and was raised in a very traditional LDS home where her father was a CES institute director and her mother's a stay-at-home mom of eight children, I'm assuming. Chelsea has been grappling with intellectual, historical, and gender issues in the church for about 15 years and has chronicled some of those experiences as a writer and through numerous interviews. Chelsea is a prominent feminist activist for religious gender equality. She is president of Mormons for ERA and on the executive board for Ordained Women and LDS Wave. Women Advocating for Voice and Equality is what that stands for. She's also the executive producer for an upcoming film on Mormon feminism and global religious inequality and contributes regularly to blogs, conferences, articles, and podcasts. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have you on the program tonight. I have listened to you on several occasions and just have a lot of respect for you, Chelsea. So welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I feel honored. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, I think I'd like to start just with, you know, a further introduction. You mentioned that you're working on a dissertation and you're an adjunct professor. Can you tell us a little bit about where that is? And then also start telling us a little bit about your kind of Mormon upbringing. How did you come to be a Mormon woman?
Well, I didn't have a lot of choice in the matter. I was born and raised as a Mormon woman. But I also, you know, like I think anyone can look back and just find phenomenal memories of being raised in such a rich culture. And, you know, it's one of those things that, and I think we'll talk about later on, is that makes it so hard to kind of grapple with some of these other issues, is you do have these social memories of a community and a people where your role was set and the rules were clear and the value was handed out, you know, if you followed that path. And so it's been, I have a lot of love and respect for my Mormon heritage. I'm very confused about my Mormon future. But I try to just, you know, embrace every single change. And they as like, I don't know, you know, I'm not as certain as I used to be when I was Mormon, but I try not to let that fall on either side of the weight, you know, on disparaging Mormonism or saying it's the end all be all. So I just try to keep, you know, value my heritage and my upbringing, but also be critical. And I think that, honestly, and maybe this is getting too far, but that's the future of religion. I look at this ISIS stuff and I see the violence is being perpetrated with religion today. And I see the way that secular liberals are commentating. And I think, you know, the future can't be all or nothing. It can't be disparaging religion or religious extremism. Like, we have to get to a place where we can understand why we have religion, why we need it, what it benefits people, and give it the respect it's due with a critical eye that says, this is not okay. And that's a really hard balance to get to. And I've definitely struggled maintaining, kind of walking that line. But that is definitely, if I were to, you know, label my Mormonism as anything in a nutshell, it's trying to walk that balance of making it better without disparaging.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of why I've really appreciated the work that you've done, is that you really come at it from a really balanced perspective, in my point of view anyway, So tell us a little bit more about kind of your growing up Mormon and what that experience was like and how that led to, or did it lead to, some of your interest in anthropology and some of the studies that you're involved with today.
Absolutely. I don't know, you might have more insight on this than me, but it was fascinating. A lot of my friends who were more lackadaisical about their Mormon belief are like still active. And those of us who were really hardcore are like, ah, we're out, or we're struggling. So I was definitely the Mormon kid who like had read my scriptures like many times, had memorized all the scriptures, you know, said in my little planner, I was like, you know, say my prayers, read my scriptures for a half an hour. Do you, you know, I took home the young women's handouts and I did them. Like, I was definitely the kid who, like, you know, to the point where maybe it was neurotic. I don't know. The Woody Allen of Mormon female Mormonism. I don't know. But I would, you know, be afraid to pray at night because we were so, you know, taught with enough faith and enough confidence, you can see the face of God, DNC 94. I think it's 93.1, 91.3, I can't remember. But I remember as a kid, as a teenager, like being fearful that like faith could move mountains. Because I was like, I had such utter faith that we could, of what I was being taught was accurate. And so as I explored, which was kind of how I embraced my Mormonism, right? It was to, oh, I have a question, go search the scriptures, ponder, pray, read, figure it out. And I think what happened is, it kind of set up this basis for academia, right? This critical thinking. But there comes a point, and I think most academics face this, where you are taught to like critically think, and sometimes the facts don't line up. And so you have to kind of weigh out, and I think each scholar does it differently, which is what facts to validate your perspective, what facts invalidate your perspective, and you kind of have to really deal with that. And I remember doing research actually on spirit possessions and animal sacrifice. And I was working with this one client in West Africa, and we were, he was, you know, sacrificing a chicken. And then the way that the chicken died determined if it was a yes or no answer from the gods. And he did it one time and it was yes. He did it another time and it was like a maybe. And so they did it another time and it was a no. And so he concluded that the answer was no, which is kind of the answer he wanted. And I said, hey, like, and I was trying to be very respectful as an anthropologist, you know, you, that's your whole role is to understand these people and understand without, you know, judgment. And, I remember saying something like, well, didn't you just continue the ritual until you got the answer that you wanted? And his response to that was, well, you can't trick a god. So if the answer was yes, every single time it would have been a clear yes. We wouldn't have had, you know, this murky halfway jumping up and halfway dying. We wouldn't have seen, we would have had clarity. We would have known. And I went home and thought about that. And I was like, oh, that's kind of just a cop out, you know, kind of rationalizing why that didn't make sense to me. And then I realized in my life, if I were to weigh out, you know, I've had 93 prayers answered in my life and 9,000 prayers unanswered. So therefore prayers don't, aren't answered, you know. And I realized in my own religious life, I had not been as systematic about how I arrived at what is evidence of truth and not. And so it just caused me, I said, I know this is kind of a long answer, but I'll hurry it. I'll wind it up here, but it caused me to reevaluate like the way that I both evaluated my religion, but also gave it the respect it needed. So I gave it so much respect, regardless of whether, you know, someone else looking from the outside would be like, hey, this doesn't mathematically make sense in the ratios of answered prayers to non-answered. And duh, that's stupid. But then it had changed my life in so many ways. And so it gave me a level of respect for the people that I work with and the religions that I've seen in the world, which, you know, has been crucial as an anthropologist to kind of be able to respect these things that we might find bizarre. But it's also given me a level of respect for my own religion as I'm stepping away, that I think a lot of it's hard as a secular person to kind of maintain that level of respect. And anyway, so it's back to the same talking point, you know, but it just was really shocking in the moment. And that's kind of what drew me to religion, drew me to study other people's belief systems and at the same time study my own.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it sounds like you had a fairly positive upbringing with Mormonism. Well, I don't know if it's positive or not. You said it was definitely rigorous in the sense of studying scriptures a lot. And it's interesting how you mentioned the level of commitment maybe had something to do with how far you had to fall. And anyway, so maybe before I get to some other questions, what would you say were the benefits for you growing up in the religious faith? I'm assuming both your parents were religious and your family system was religious and kind of embraced this Mormon lifestyle, or was it somewhat different than that?
No, it's definitely like, you know, each side has 9 siblings and their wives and their 7 kids each, and they're all Mormon, and, you know, the previous generations are all Mormon. And so it's a very Mormon heritage and ethnicity and people and family. Like everything I did in my life was based on being a Mormon. So, you know, whether how we talked about love, how we talked about decision making, how we talked about who to marry, like any decision you made was through, I like to call it through Mormon colored glasses. You know, I was really incapable of seeing the world without viewing it from this Mormon perspective. So in some ways it was, and maybe we'll talk about this later, but in some ways that's really helpful for someone healthy, because you're able to not have to deal with like these existential questions of life and death, and you're able not to have to spend your teenage years like worrying about how far to go or what level, you know, you're able to have these answers fixed and set up so that you're not having to worry about all of life's contingencies. If you're part of a religion that's very clear and very strict in a way, you have the answers, and that's actually quite healthy mentally. The problem comes when maybe those perimeters are broken, or maybe the answers aren't being met, or maybe the facts don't line up. And so that's when it becomes really problematic to have clear answers if they don't line up, because then you're just screwed. Your paradigm has been crushed. But if you are a believing Mormon, it's actually very, very healthy, to be able to, you know, not be constantly vigilant about these questions where there's not clear answers, and you're able to move on and focus your attention and energy elsewhere. And in some ways that was my childhood. In some ways I had to face some of these questions early on. I had a brother that passed away, quite traumatically, when he was 15 and I was 17, and I, you know, had to face a lot of questions at his death of like, well, why couldn't we have saved him? Well, doesn't faith work? And if faith works, why didn't we do that? And I guess it doesn't work in times of emergency. And I think it's the questions of God that we all face, which is going to church the next week and hearing about how someone, you know, prayed and God helped them find their keys. And I'm thinking, then why does he let genocide and pedophilia and my brother, you know, my brother's death could have been prevented by 2 seconds, you know? So it's all of those questions that I had to face early on, which then sets you on a path where that paradigm no longer holds water for you. And from that point on, religion can be quite problematic.
So this family trauma, I mean, that sounds horrific. I don't know if this was an accident or something that happened with your brother, but did this affect other family members in the same way? At that point, did you see kind of a divergence in grievance styles? Because I know that in my work with LDS clients around tragedies, some people seem to find their religious beliefs just completely soothing and peaceful and comforting, and others, you know, kind of like what you're describing, starts having a domino effect on unanswered questions, and it just not making sense anymore.
Right. And we saw that. I mean, my dad definitely had his faith, and my mom completely restored with something like that. I mean, it's the whole thing of, well, how could you not believe in life after death? And I did have some very spiritual experiences with that, actually, that are hard to, you know, not that I would want to explain them away, but they are hard to explain away if we have a model for meaning making that makes sense, you know, if that was the spirit and it told me this thing. And so a lot of my family members, it was a very, spiritually, rich and, testimony building experience. But I think, like you said, for me, it was just starting. It was the little ounces of doubt that started creeping in, which, you know, which I think matched to my personality. I think that I've always, like you said, you know, here's a question, go out and find all the answers you can possibly find and make the best decision with the most amount of information possible. And if that's the way you approach life, especially from a modern perspective, modern people try to evaluate religion based on these cognitive or intellectual or historical bases or even literal. And religions are never meant to hold up to that kind of scrutiny. So if that's the basis of quote unquote truth for you, religions will fail you. If the basis of truth for you is this experience of belief or the social experience of community, religions will hold up quite well for you, or emotional, if what you're getting out of it is emotional, you know, maintenance or regulation, or I'm feeling uncomfortable. This bad thing happened to me. I can go confess. I can get forgiveness. I can feel good. I know how to do that. And then religion can provide you the types of value that you need. I think, what happens in our modern world is like we tend to look at those other ways of finding truth or value or benefit as less than the cognitive truth of what is absolutely real or historically accurate. And we base all of our truth in those realms. And I think that's why so many of us struggle to deal with these positive feelings we had about religion and negative with this idea of truth. And even I'm saying it as a negative example, as an academic, you know, if you're a critical thinker and you evaluate all the evidence, and it's going to be hard for you to argue the rest of your life with as much evidence as possible that it's a literal, absolute truth. And, so I think that is half personality, right? And I think it's half, how you approach religion and what it means to you and what you want to get out of it and how you evaluate truth.
Well, and we may get into this more, but this is why, you know, just exactly what you just said, I think is important to understand as we, as members of this Mormon community, are faced with different experiences, right? And oftentimes the only one that's validated in the church setting is the believing perspective. And that type of personality and that type of personage who really does gain benefit from these belief systems and these, you know, sacred pieces of how they frame the world. But oftentimes those who don't fit into that paradigm do not get validated and then are even villainized in some ways. And so we can get into that a little bit more as far as just maybe from the anthropological view of how you have seen different cultures kind of face those issues. I think I'm imagining that's a pretty common occurrence. It's not just a Mormon thing. That's a pretty common across different religions or different cultures phenomenon.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's the cultural perspective, which is, you know, kind of boundary making, who's in group, who's out group, how we determine. And there's a lot of what I call, what anthropologists would call costly signals to kind of determine your group commitment or your loyalty to the group or your trustworthiness, right? And so you see someone wearing garments and there's a certain, there's about 100 different characteristics that come packaged in that symbol. And that's what symbols are, right? Is it's a bunch of packaged, prepackaged meaning. It is so much easier to grasp instantaneously than to evaluate every single person and process all the information from a novel place. And so that's why we have things like stereotypes, right? It's not good. It's just it's a process of our brain of quick decision making. And so when we see someone wearing garments that looks Mormon, we can immediately know 100 things about them. And that's why so many religions have these types of costly signals, from the hijab to, you know, the yarmulke, to you name it. Every religion has a different type of overt symbol of their commitment to the group. And as you stop wearing those symbols, you're seen as less committed to the group. So you wear a tank top, and I know 100 things about you now, and it's a different 100 things, right? And whether that's good or bad, because it does place judgment, like just like stereotypes can be quite harmful. It can make you feel like you're on the outside of the group, and it could lead to discrimination and pain. And you know, there's enormous amounts of, we can even talk about LGBT feelings of suicide and you know, actual hate crimes and hate speech. And so I'm not trying to belittle the consequences or ramifications of boundary making, but it is a way that every group in the world has been able to show who you can trust and who you can't, and how we can learn from each other instantly about if we have the same value system, if we know the same thing. Even a testimony you can tell instantaneously via the words we use whether someone's a lifetime member or whether someone's new. They'll just say it a little bit differently. They'll phrase things a little bit differently, and you're like, oh, that must be a convert, or that must be someone new. And even if they don't say anything wrong, if you've been a member your whole life, you know. And we use those symbols to kind of help us navigate the world. And you could argue you do that watching football, right? You can tell who knows the game and who doesn't based on how they communicate and how they talk. And so that it's a good thing and a bad thing.
Well, and this, I think, goes back to, I mean, I remember when, you know, when studying sociology or some of these other social sciences, this idea that we do need, from an evolutionary standpoint, I guess, to organize and label information, because there's so much data coming into our computer brain, right, that if we don't do that, then we just get overloaded. And so kind of back to your point about why religion can be very useful for many people is that it organizes and structures your life in a way that it opens up energy for other aspects, and you don't have to spend a lot of time figuring this particular stuff out. And this could be a lot of different things, not just religion. Like, there's lots of different systems in place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you probably know more mental health wise, but one of the things I talk about in my dissertation and when I talk to people is, you know, there's a lot of things that we consider bad that, you know, are advantageous, and that's why they evolved. So you talk about like dominance hierarchies or status. Like, there's enormous problems with status, with inequality, with discrimination, with the ways we structure class and society. But it's a feature of every primate society. You know, and there's a reason why we have things like status. And one of the reasons is if each individual human was constantly socially vigilant, trying to figure out who's our ally, who's our foe, where we fit, where every interaction we have with another human is a dominance contest, and we're trying to show our dominance. I mean, you cannot survive that level of just physiological cortisol overload. You know, you can't survive being in a state of stress and contest that often, and you can't, you know, get anything done if every interaction you have is a test. And so what we do is we create kind of these systems of status where, okay, this is the dominant, and until someone takes them over, we're just going to all accept that. And so we can move on with our lives until they fail as a leader or until someone else comes up. And I'm actually happy taking a less dominant role in order that I can trust the people above me, below me, and to the sides of me, and can move on with my life. You know, and we do this every single day in our lives with friendships, with anything. You know, the first day of high school, that's, we're in the socially vigilant state. We're constantly looking out, who should we sit by at the table? What should happen? We're very, very stressed. As soon as we kind of find our group, we can relax. We can focus on looking outside ourselves. We can kind of, you know, feel like someone has my back and I'm protected, I'm safe. And even though those friends you picked in high school might not be your friends today, or were a natural fit, or maybe you were in the wrong group or whatever, just by virtue of finding kind of this niche, you can now focus your energy elsewhere. And that's how I see a lot of the ways we approach, you know, religion and communities is it's an adaptive system that allows us to kind of get those basic needs met of safety and connection and protection. And so we can move on and have these deeper connections, or have, you know, exert our energies elsewhere.
Yeah, so forgive me for going back to this, and you can tell me to butt out if you want me to, but the last time I met you, well, the first time actually that I met you face-to-face, I think was, oh, I'm going to say last summer, we were joined together in a panel discussion, and then later I think Dan Witherspoon over at Mormon Matters did a similar interview with several of us, kind of opining on the issues around the excommunication of Kate Kelly. Now, if I remember correctly, and I may be totally wrong, it was my impression at the time that you were considering or presenting yourself as still an active member of the church. Am I totally off base on that?
No, I mean, I would say I had Temple Recommend until a year ago. So about a year ago, I decided, and it was actually kind of an interesting conversation. I asked my dad, I said, I went to the temple, and I've been to the temple for, you know, a decade, and it never was great. And I tried and tried. And like you said earlier, if the temple's not wonderful, there is no there is no narrative or script for, oh, the temple's not wonderful. The narrative or script is you failed somehow. You're not trying hard enough. You're not praying hard enough. You're not worthy enough. You're not. And so for me, what was hard as like an active Mormon, keeping all the rules, but just having intellectual struggles was I can't keep the rules more. I can't try harder. And so if this isn't working, I have to walk around life feeling like a failure, like something's wrong with me. And so I think for a while there, for a couple of years there, I've tried to be in this middle space. And I think about a year ago, I was kind of like done with being in the middle space. And I don't know what that puts me at, but I just, you know, I don't know. I don't know where I am. But
okay, yeah, and not to put you on the spot or anything, but I just
that's fine. I'm totally open.
Okay. Well, and it was just surprising to hear you say at the beginning of this podcast that you know I don't know how you label it. Like you're not considering yourself a member, or you're not considering yourself maybe an active member, or however it is that you phrase that. And I know as people transition, they phrase that in many different ways.
Right.
And so that just seems like that's still very much a part of your kind of current journey. Process. Okay.
And I don't think we have good verbiage for that, right? I think we've tried. We have so many different groups to kind of be the next thing as you're transitioning away, or you want to still have the heritage but not the belief system or whatever. We don't have reformed Mormonism, right? We don't have a great we don't have secular Mormonism. We don't have a great system in place. Like I said, it's a self-correcting system. So if it doesn't work for you, the operator, it's the user that's the failure. And so there is no world where you exist, where you can be both successful and that the system failed. And so I think that's one of the struggles that I think a lot of post-Mormons are facing today, is trying to figure out what that means for them and then their families. My parents are also trying to figure out what that means.
Because they're still very committed and dedicated to the church, I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's hard for them to understand. Well, why don't you just believe more? Why don't you just read your scriptures more? Why don't you just pray harder? So that's a hard thing after a long time.
And from an anthropological perspective, do you see and the possibility of reformation within the church? I mean, you know, I often hear of other people talking about Judaism or even Catholicism and how there's different levels of, I guess, orthodoxy and other religions that have been around longer than Mormonism. Is that something that you think is even worth talking about?
I don't know. I mean, we are a really young religion. So at this point, a lot of people just leave. And there has to be enough, like I said earlier, respect and care and desire to like maintain a system, but change it. That's a lot harder than just switching systems or leaving. So, you know, I think that we see, which is quite fascinating, you know, I've been doing Mormon feminism since I moved to Boston in 2005. So it's been 10 years, and we do see a Mormon resistance movement. We do see people who have been trying to make big changes and small changes for years. And so we do see the church like on a trajectory of change. But will it ever fully embrace like non-literal members? You know, I don't know. I think that's not a question just for Mormonism. I think that's a question for all religions as we move into an information age. Can any, you know, literal religion last the next 100 years? And I don't know about that.
Okay, so let's dive a little bit. I mean, just a little bit of time I'd love to spend on your dissertation. Tell us about that and what you're finding and what your theories are, or what it is that you're trying to accomplish through that process.
Absolutely. I am definitely a very slow writer. These ideas have taken me a long time to build and percolate, and I've had to go back and actually get a second PhD to get what I wanted to say out. And so basically what I'm trying to...
So you already have one PhD, you're going for your second? Is that what you're telling
me? I'm doing
me?
Both at the same time. Okay. So I did all the stuff for cultural anthropology and then realized I was studying indigenous healing. and realized I can talk all I want about kind of what we've been talking about, right? Like the community, the belief system, the meaning system, and how it makes you feel better. And I can talk about all of this stuff of like the benefits and adverse aspects of religion. But I can't really apply those to health unless I actually know what I'm talking about physiologically. And so I went back and did all of the coursework and the comprehensive exams in biological anthropology as well. And so now I'm finishing the dissertation. It's in the editing stage. It's, you know, an enormous beast, but it has both. It's basically the evolution of our bodies and why our bodies respond to psychosocial triggers. So why? And it's a question not many people are asking. So it is, I'm like a expert in a really tiny field. So why would human bodies evolve to be capable of experiencing a placebo effect? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Why would you respond to something that's not active, right? And so that's the first part of my dissertation, is it gets into all of the physiology of how our bodies evolved and healing systems and how to trigger those placebo responses and why that works and how that would have been advantageous, like on the Pleistocene. And then the second half of the dissertation is about, okay, well, let's take a bunch of examples in context, because we know that culture matters actually in a placebo. We know how to manipulate a placebo response to be magnified or lessened. And that has a lot to do with your meaning system, what your belief system. And so, you have to know all of that stuff to kind of see how it's triggered. And so then I give all these examples through Ashanti medicine, and people often are like, oh, you're saying that all they're doing is placebos. And that's not what I'm trying to argue at all. I'm saying, people, including modern medicine, and I can give you a few examples, are tapping into these stone age systems that evolved for hundreds of thousands of years in order to make changes in our body. And that's fascinating. And, you know, we need to incorporate that when we talk about alternative medicines. And I'm not saying that's the end all be all. We also need to incorporate that when we talk about biomedicine. And both of those things are going to be really critical in the future. One of the examples that I think you'll love that a lot of people are fascinated by, it was a talk I gave at TED actually, is about pain and pain systems. And a lot of people who self-harm and cut, not only do they feel bad for the negative emotions or social pain they're experiencing, but then they feel guilty for coping via self-harm. So on top of feeling bad, their coping mechanism, now they feel bad for that, but then they did get a physiological relief. And so so it becomes a cyclical pattern, sometimes even addictive. And so one of the things I bring up is examples from some bone setters I worked with, where when a patient I had one patient had a broken arm, and he would go to the bone setter, and right before the bone setter grabbed his arm, which would be enormously painful, right? To get your arm set and to get it massaged on a daily basis when it's broken, he kind of winced. And what the bone setter did is he kind of made fun of the kid. He gathered a bunch of the old women in that were sitting by him, and he said, "Hey, look at this small boy. He is so weak. He will cry from a small wound." You know, and he was kind of making fun of this kid. And I saw this a lot in the field. And I spent years being like, why would they do that? Like, that seems like a terrible system. And yet when you study the physiology and the evolution, what's fascinating is that our social pain systems, which is, you know, when you feel embarrassed or hurt or anxious or anything that causes you kind of that social pain feeling, they evolved after our physical pain systems. And so, you know, when we watch a skateboarder, crash, and it's a terrible crash, and they probably broke their femur, but all their friends are around, they kind of get up and they're like, it's cool, I'm good. And what happened right then was they felt so much embarrassment that actually co-opted the same neural pathways, and you're not able to feel both at the same time. And so what people who are self-harming are doing is causing themselves, and you know this as a therapist, but they're causing themselves physical pain so they can alleviate their social pain. And so what I try to talk about in the second half of my dissertation is we need to stop denigrating these alternative and indigenous medicine systems. We think that they're so in your head and so stupid and bizarre, and really making fun of that boy in a land. I mean, I was 12 hours from any big city. Like, there is no pain medicine available for that kid in a 12-mile radius. You know, I mean, that's probably exaggerating. Probably in a 3-mile radius, there's not one, sorry, 3-hour radius. There was not one way he could access pain medication. And so that making fun of him was probably the smartest thing the bone setter could have done in the moment to alleviate his actual experience of feeling pain. And what he did is he tapped into these endogenous systems from our Stone Age bodies. And what the teenager is doing when they're self-harming is tapping into these old systems. And what I would tell a patient, you know, from the applied, what to gather from all of this research, the applied approach is, you know, like, good for you. You figured out this incredibly complicated biocultural feedback loop, and it's not the healthiest, and it's not working, and you probably shouldn't be your only coping mechanism. But good for you. You know, instead of feeling guilty for coping, we got to understand why we go to the coping mechanisms we go to and kind of figure out that evolved body so that we can do it better next time. And so that's kind of the end goal of the dissertation, is to take all of this information to validate some of these coping mechanisms and healing systems in the world that we kind of denigrate, but also to incorporate in our lives, to kind of incorporate these evolutionary medical perspectives in our applied practices today.
So I'm curious, like, thinking about the bone setter, for example, would you say that I'm assuming this was a gentleman, was aware of what he was doing, that he was consciously saying, I'm going to make fun of this kid because that'll tap into his pain reserves? Or is that a subconscious or even unconscious cultural process that has developed in that community over time, and that's just how they behave?
The latter. And that's, you know, definitely, I argue the same for religion. I think that a lot of the practices we have that we see universal around the world developed over time because they worked. They alleviated pain and suffering. And there's a reason that every religion on the planet has some form of confession and forgiveness, right? There's a reason they have hierarchical systems and clear rules. There's a reason. And I think the same thing about some healing systems. There's a reason why certain personalities of doctors are more effective. And we can get into the science of that, or we can get into the social evolution of that. But over time, you're going to begin to see healing systems and religious systems develop in a way that gives you the coping that you need. And I don't think each individual doctor or each individual, you know, parishioner understands why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, most biomedical doctors don't know evolutionary medicine, right? Or don't know that they're triggering a placebo effect when they tell the patient this phrase, even in our own medical system. So consciousness is not necessarily needed for it to work.
Right. Yeah. That would have been my guess as well. So yeah. So this brings up a whole nother kind of level of, you know, like, I don't know what your experience was personally observing this young boy being taunted, but many of us would cringe at that, right? Or try to come in and protect that young boy. And yet at some level, we would probably understand that even though it's helping him in that moment, there's something traumatic about that process of those women right. Making fun of him too. So what are your thoughts about short-term strategy versus right. Like long-term?
I'm not recommending for doctors to go out and make fun of their patients. Okay. That's why I always argue, like, it has to be context-based. So in an American hospital, you wouldn't need that. You have access to pain medication and pain management. So it would be unnecessary. And in fact, it'd be considered quite cruel, because no one, even the patient and the doctor, wouldn't be prepared for such an action. But in a culture where that's normal, it you know, facilitates their role. So I definitely don't recommend it. I think one thing that's fascinating, and why I just love anthropology so much, is one of our main methodologies is you have to live there at a minimum a year. And most of us live there much longer, go back many times, you know. And the reason why I think that's so important is the first couple times I saw stuff like this, like I saw a pregnant woman getting slapped. I saw, you know, people getting yelled at for getting hurt. I saw boys be made, you know, this boy be made fun of. I saw all of these examples of these things. And in the moment, even to like a 6-year-old girl got severely burned all the way down her back. She was carrying hot oil on her head and it fell. And 6-year-old, and these nurses were being kind of harsh with her. And I wanted to go over and just like put her on my lap and cuddle her. I mean, that's how I would comfort my daughter, right? That was my instinct, was like, what? Why are you screaming? I want to protect this girl. And what's fascinating is after being there, over a year, I brought some students there. I ran a Ghana medical anthropology study abroad from BYU, actually. I won't mention any names, but I brought some students there and I was doing rounds in the local hospital. And one of the students sat, you know, a sweet Mormon Mother Teresa syndrome, 19-year-old girl going to Africa for the first time, sits next to a patient and does exactly what I wanted to do for the first 6 months of witnessing all this stuff. She sits next to a patient, puts her arm around there, you know, gives her comfort, speaks to her kindly. And my entire body, I call it like emotional intelligence or social intelligence. My entire body like tightened up and I was like, no, she shouldn't be doing that. And that's what I wanted to do 6 months ago. And I couldn't figure out, why do I feel so uncomfortable with this student, to the point where I feel as her advisor, I need to tell her, you cannot do that. Please don't comfort patients. And I had to think about that for a while. And what I realized was, that in the culture we were in, you never see that type of comfort to someone, because there is no immediate morphine drip. There is no pain medicine. There is no access to these things that are going to get rid of your pain. And so a lot of the pain management systems are like, you can do it, be tough. It's normalizing the pain. It's making it, well, just don't carry hot water on your head. You know, it's very like, the way to distract your mind, normalize the pain, numb you. Pain is one of those things that you can either exacerbate or lessen based on your meaning system and your expectations. So if you comfort someone, they actually, in Africa, I'm not saying this would happen here, but you're actually communicating to them that there's no hope, that they can't just tough it through, that they, you know, there's no point in being like stoic because they're not going to survive. And I realized the only times I had seen this type of comfort were for there's no chance of survival, for uncurable, you know,
almost like hospice cases. Care here. Or
yeah.
Something.
When people were going to die, that's when I saw healthcare practitioners be kind and comforting. And so I realized everyone in the room, but us Americans, including the patient, we're gathering from her behavior that this was a very serious problem, and it wasn't, you know, and that she was violating some of these tacit, communication, symbols and communicating something totally different. And I could not have picked up on that in the first 6 months. And that's, we're not even talking about the physiology here. We're just talking about, these are things that take so long to figure out, and you can't just ask a doctor, why do you do that, and have them consciously tell you. And that's one of the reasons why I love anthropology so much, is it takes time to be there and to be the outsider and to be confused and to ask and to figure out, and it takes time to figure out these really large scale patterns. And I think you could do the same thing for like Mormon communication, right? Of when we feel uncomfortable and when we don't. And it's breaking these rules that we didn't even realize were rules.
Well, and even to take it a step further, I think that oftentimes we as Mormons are surprised or shocked as to how we're perceived by those in our grander community. Let's say here in the United States, for example. This kind of, I think, speaks to this idea that, you know, some people might think of our, let's say the way we keep the word of wisdom, for example, is harsh and rigid and weird or strict, you know, when it comes to coffee or tea. I think most people would agree about illicit drugs, but, or, you know, again, modesty, you know, shoulders or certain lengths of skirts. And I think, again, we see those things as very, they make sense to those within the context of the Mormon community, whereas for outsiders, it doesn't make sense. And then we're almost offended or feel misunderstood or even persecuted because people won't attribute the same value or kind of concepts like we do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's benefit to having that outsider kind of see something that you just kind of never noticed, and then force you to think about it and explain it and kind of explain these patterns that you're like, huh, I never thought about that. And there's also, you know, an ethnocentrism there. So it's this fine line that I'm like, I'm always, you know, trying to walk, which is I should not be the person writing any type of ethnography on, you know, Ashanti medicine. It should be an Ashanti healer, you know? So it's a hard balance to walk as an anthropologist of insider, outsider. I feel the same way about my community. I definitely think it'd be fascinating to write something on healing and placebos in regard to, you know, patriarchal blessings or priesthood blessings. And yet at the same time, as the insider, am I going to be missing some really important things that that someone from the outside would, even though I'm getting some of these internal things that they couldn't? So it's just a fascinating kind of line, but I think it's really helpful for us. And I think in Mormon studies, particularly in the modern age, what's lacking, we have tons of historians, and what's lacking is really culture theory. We don't have a lot of people trying to parse apart and analyze the big patterns of behavior and belief and meaning in regard to Mormon culture. And I think it's hard for us to do that. And, you know, to our detriment, I think we're not getting some of these theories and these big patterns because we're not analyzing it the way that we should. So, I mean, I don't have a solution. I still haven't, you know, decided if I'm going to ever write anything on Mormons, but I think, I hope in the next generation, instead of seeing just Mormon historians, we're going to, you know, we're going to start to see, and I think you and, are doing a great job in regard to, social psychology and psychology in Mormonism. And I hope we see the same thing in the social sciences as well.
Yes, it's almost like this interplay between outsiders and insiders is necessary for growth, for self-awareness as a culture, for a lot of different things that if you're only an outsider or only an insider and don't interplay those two, you're just not going to be aware of certain things, it seems like.
Absolutely.
So, well, and I love what you said about cutting, for example. I mean, I think, you know, from my training, I was very systemically trained, and there was definitely this kind of focus on positivity and strength-based attributes. And so instead of looking at a client, in fact, we were trained to use the word client, not patient, because in a sense, patient, you know, has a sense of illness or disease associated to it. And I know not all psychologists are necessarily trained in that regard, but as a marriage and family therapist, I was trained that way. And we were really looking for symptoms as strengths. So how do you reframe them? So in other words, like you very well explained, you know, the cutting can seem like this negative symptom. And of course it's scary and fearful, especially for loved ones who don't understand what's happening. But when you reframe it, like you very well stated, it's this kind of way to survive something that's very difficult. And cutting in particular is not, for example, a suicidal trend. Usually it's usually just a coping mechanism, and we all cope in different ways. And of course, society and culture makes certain coping mechanisms, higher in value than others. So if you are a runner or exercise, that's highly valued in our current society. Whereas if you, you know, eat 12 donuts, that's not as valued in our current society, or, you know, certain things are. And so there's all these different ways to look at family systems. And I think religious systems, any system where you can look at what seems like a problematic perspective and really try to understand, okay, what's the survival behind this? What's at the core of what would drive somebody to act in a way that seems self-harmful, or the system is acting in a way that seems self-harmful, when really in reality there's something beyond that that's more complex, more interesting, and speaks to the, I don't know, to the paradox, right, of humanity.
Absolutely. I completely agree. You know, the only difference that I take in kind of my approach to all this is I just take it from, and it's because we're of our different trainings, and I think you need both of it, right? Is I just take it to that extra level of evolution, and I argue, how can something that's so maladaptive today, why would that have been selected for? Or what system is this preying on of these old bodies, right? And I think that's helpful for me to kind of take it to that level and kind of try to analyze our coping mechanisms and our behaviors. Because one of the things that's interesting is that our worlds have changed so much. I used to talk to my grandma and we said, oh, you were the valedictorian. And her response was always, yeah, well, there was only five people in my class. You know, like she graduated with five people. So she, her valedictorian status, she just always thought was funny. And I graduated from 500, and my daughter, who knows, she might have a class of 5,000. You know, it's just these, our social systems are exponentially expanding, our way to connect to each other, even from when I was dating to how people date today to how my daughter will date, you know, or friendships or social networking, or our systems are expanding so rapidly. And our bodies are not. Our brains and our bodies are very slow to develop. And so I think you and I have talked about this once before, where our Stone Age bodies in this modern world are inundated with these feelings that we were never supposed to have long term. So we were supposed to get anxious before we gave a big speech so that we didn't mess it up and not have any friends. You're supposed to get depressed if someone breaks up with you, because that was clearly a betrayal and you chose the wrong person and you didn't have time to figure out a better choice next time, or you're never going to have any friends or allies or protection or safety or resources or whatever. So we have all these things. You're supposed to like have your parents, censure you so that you kind of stay within the lines of society so that you can become a prominent member. But what's happening in a modern world is, you know, we're experiencing rejection, heartbreak, loss, ostracism, grief, discrimination, inequality at these rates that are, we were never meant to handle. You know, in a society of 100, you would not be facing these things at this rate. And so one of my takeaways, from all of this research is just that we have to develop better coping mechanisms, and we have to teach our kids. It can't just be, you know, so often we figure out how to cope and our parents figured it out, and we kind of let our kids figure it out. We don't ask them, oh, you're feeling negative emotions. What are you going to do to change those feelings? We kind of just let them choose 12 donuts or a sports team. And I think that's fascinating as an outsider. If I'm trying to look at it from an outside perspective, I would be like, Americans are crazy. And it's not just Americans, but I would be like, Americans are insane. Your high school kid is going to get, you know, rejected. He's going to feel bad. Are you going to let him choose basketball or heroin? Like, don't you want to direct that process? You know, don't we want to like help our kid figure out how to deal with bullying and how to cope? And one of the reasons we don't, I think, and I want to hear what you say, because this could just be me waxing poetic, but is that no one ever taught us. We just figured it out. And some of the best coping mechanisms, and I only use the word best to mean most effective, quickest acting, are food, sex, drugs, alcohol, porn, you know, like a lot of them aren't what we want to teach our kid to do. So I think that's one of the reasons we don't teach our kids. And if these negative emotions are only going to expand as time goes on, we need to be better about it. And that's one of the reasons why I think religion has persisted despite truth claims being kind of argued away, or despite proof not being there, is religion is actually a really good community. It's a good coping mechanism. It helps us in so many ways. And so, you know, I'm not saying that that's what we should do. I'm just saying, you know, there's a reason why people cling to it so tightly and why it is very effective. You know, we could talk about specifics in a minute, but I think that, you know, one of the biggest things we're going to face in our generation is more mental illness. CDC said it's a pandemic in our generation, and we don't know how to deal with it as a society.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that. I think that, you know, when you talk about these natural responses, I mean, adrenaline, for example, is not necessarily something that's supposed to be coursing through our system all the time. You know, back to your point, from an evolutionary standpoint, it's very useful when you have to run away from like the tiger or being hunted or something along those lines, because then all your, you know, your body responds, and instead of having your blood in your brain, you have your blood in your arms and legs, and it gives you all this strength and capacity. And so, not that I could quote you the research, but, you know, I've heard that, or read that your IQ actually lowers as you get into your fight flight response. And so I talk to my couples about that a lot. It's like, you know, when you're in fight flight mode and you're feeling really threatened by each other, it's usually not always the best time to be real logical with one another as far as what you're going to be saying or feeling or et cetera, because you're your body is ready to run or fight and or freezes instead of coming to some, you know, real problem solution focused type of place. So I think even in couples work, we work a lot on kind of self-management, self-soothing, and getting to a place where communicating is even possible. A lot of people think, oh, I need to work on my communication tools first, but that's not even really in the process if you're at that state of real hyper arousal, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean the good kind of arousal.
Autonomic system. I get it.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. One of the stories I tell is the cultural relativity of childbirth. And people don't often think, because it's such a natural, you know, everyone is here because someone gave birth to us. So, you know, we typically think of it as this universal physiological thing. And what happens is people give birth in so many different ways based on what culture you're in. And all it takes is for you to watch one or two births in a society where it's not, you know, in a hospital with a hospital gown, it's considered normal with, you know, your sisters and your mothers, and for you to be like, huh, maybe it isn't this enormously crazy people screaming their eyes out, you know, thing. And what's fascinating about what you just said is it's true. When you feel stress, your blood does rush to your arms and legs. What happens is it rushes away from your cervix, and it is harder to give birth. And in fact, it can stop labor. And so many, I shouldn't be so blasé, but a lot of the complications in birth from labor being stopped, the heart rate of your infant, you know, increasing, to not having enough blood flow, to having severe pain, a lot of that is stimulated or exacerbated by feeling stress. And a lot of that comes from our cultural expectations of birth. So, you know, it's one of those systems where I never try to denigrate biomedicine. I think it's amazing. If I got sick, I'd go there tomorrow. However, you know, there's a lot we can learn about our bodies and how things work, and that biomedicine is a system too. And the reason we take women to the hospital is that that's been our tradition, you know, and the reason, you know, there are so many cesarean sections, it has a little bit to do with insurance companies. And I'm not trying to like spin some new agey like conspiracy theory. And so it's a fine line to walk, but I definitely think, understanding these processes from anyone's perspective is going to be more beneficial and effective. And so, you know, I think, yes, still go to the hospital, still have all the medical research you can possibly have, but also have this other research. Also know how your body works and how it responds to environmental conditions, because our body has evolved to be highly sensitive to our environmental conditions, and not even just our actual conditions. And this is where you come in, which I think is fascinating. It's our perceived conditions. So our brains are so intelligent that not only can we experience our current condition, we can think about imagined conditions. We can create a scenario where our doctor hates us. We can create a scenario where we remember someone else experiencing something and empathetically experiencing a stressor. Like, we are capable of imagined and perceived conditions, which then change our physiology. So it's just this fascinating interplay between our bodies and culture and our psychology that I think, you know, is fascinating as we move forward in academia and practice.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, back even in my BYU days when we, you know, when I took Psych 101, I mean, we learned the classic nature versus nurture, right? And it's been interesting as a practitioner and as, you know, continuing my studies in the social science fields, is that discussion, that dialogue has been just like burst open. I mean, it's so much more complicated than even just nature and nurture. You know, it's just like, you know, you've got biology, and that's even different from genetics. I mean, you know, it's interesting how, you know, you've got personality, and that's different from psychology. I mean, you've got like 20 different words to describe all the different areas where a person can be perceived from the system perspective, right? That all these different pieces and parts make up this whole, and you're a sum of that, of those parts, not, you know, not any one of those things. And so it just really, aligns, I think, with what you're saying, as far as, just these different perspectives of how we can integrate so many different ideas and thoughts to this. Of course, then the other part of me is getting overwhelmed again, right? Because it's like that, right. You know, like I want to label everything and organize everything, kind of back to our first point. And it's sometimes it gets, you know, that's why they say the older you get, the dumber you are, because there's just, you realize again, more and more so what how much of the unknown there is. Going back to your coping mechanisms talk, you know, I think it's interesting as you mentioned this bone setter in this other country, because I think we have a remnant of that here as well. And by here, I mean United States culture, as far as the toughness. And I think especially for the male culture, this is very true, where, you know, when we start talking about coping mechanisms and helping people through trauma, you'll often get, or I've often gotten responses of the sort of, you know, this is just psychobabble. This is, you know, it gets poo-pooed by maybe remnants of our society that are, I'm not sure remnants is the right word, I'm sorry, but parts of our society where, you know, that stoicness and that toughen up and, you know, pick yourself up by your bootstraps type of mentality is seen as the way to go. And anything that's more caring or empathic is seen as either weak or effeminate or not helping you get ahead in the world. You know, so there's this constant kind of pull and push, even in our current culture, that maybe isn't as stark as what you're describing over in West Africa, but I think is definitely that same idea. Because I don't get the sense that these people who say, oh, you're just full of crap, are insensitive, uncaring people. I just see that they have a different perspective of what's truly going to be helpful for their child, for themselves, for their spouse, for whoever it is that we're trying to help in that moment.
Right. And, you know, there is some benefit to normalizing, but it crosses a line when it becomes dismissing, you know, and what's hard. And again, we're just adding like variable upon variable. And so it's so confusing and overwhelming. But what's hard is then you have generational cultures. And so you do have a culture where, grin and bear it, pick yourself up by the bootstraps, yeah, you have these feelings, but you have a family, so just get on with it or whatever. However, you know, our grandfathers were taught to deal with the types of emotions they're experiencing. In a world where that was the norm and that's what you did, you know, it was a way to cope. And in a new generation, there's a different way because you see different options available and you don't, there isn't, you know, and so you have this general divide, but what worked for your grandpa is not working for you. And him saying that is actually dismissing the feelings that you're having, and you expressing it a different way dismisses the pain he went through to cope that way. And so we do have, on top of everything, and I see this a lot with modern youth in the church versus general authorities, is we see these generational gaps where we're talking above each other culturally. And we're trying to like share what's the most important thing to us. And we feel like the other generation is completely dismissing it. And they both feel affronted on both sides.
What a mess. What a mess. And I really appreciate your kind of like bringing up the evolutionary piece of this. I'm currently reading the book Younger Next Year, you know, just trying to get into better physical shape myself and et cetera. Anyway, they totally come from this perspective of the evolution and of our bodies. And as you were talking, it reminded me of that because, you know, when we really think about how long ago it was that we truly were in a state of being where every day was about survival and, you know, getting enough food and warmth or whatever it was for you and your family to survive. It's really been a short period of time where we haven't been in that type of a position, you know, as a human race. And so this whole discussion just kind of reminds me again of what you're saying, that I think at some level, even generationally speaking, I'm not sure that those gaps were quite as large, you know, 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago. Not enough had changed in during, you know, in the midst of the generation where where that was, I think it's always there a little bit, just because developmentally we're supposed to, I think at some level, reject the older people and disrespect them so that we can survive and be independent and
become the next alpha.
Because it's kind of like the lions or whatever, they get rid of the oldest alpha. But so these are kind of cruel ideas, but they do apply in a sense to us as well, unfortunately. And but it is towards survival, and it is I think generationally appropriate, again looking at it from a positive perspective, for the youth to move forward in ways where they're most likely to survive. And in this, you know, information age, as you called it, that's changing at a pretty quick pace. I know that, I mean, I'm in my mid-40s, and so that's neither necessarily super young nor elderly, but even I, you know, have had quite a bit of trouble keeping up with the technology, because it was really introduced to me in my early 20s, quite frankly. So that's a lot of change in a short amount of time.
Absolutely.
Okay, so is there anything else that you want to talk about, particularly with the physiology or the benefits of religion or anything along those lines, before we shift gears into some of the feminist issues I want to speak with you about?
No, I'm happy to shift, yeah.
Okay, we talked about religion offering structure and a place for hierarchy and organization and forgiveness and all those kinds of things and answers, maybe. So anything else you want to add to that list before we move on?
Well, I mean, and we just talked about just having a community. So our bodies are, and our brains are meant to go crazy when, you know, we actually have a reward punishment system that gives us dopamine and oxytocin and great hormonal rushes that are pleasurable when we do something pro-social, when we get applause and praise and promotions and first kisses and proposal acceptances, and when we get a, you know, a new calling, and when people like us, and we get pain. We literally get the negative side of that when we, you know, as something as simple as this happened to me the other day, you know, instead of saying, "How are you?" he said something like, "What's up?" And my response was, "I'm fine." And then it was really awkward. And I was like, and my body, something that simple actually felt like this moment of like, ew, like I made a mistake. I predicted incorrectly. And our bodies are made to do that. We're made to feel bad when our community doesn't like us. We're made to feel bad when we're rejected or ostracized or when we're on the fringes of society. And you know, that's on purpose. And I think knowing that gives us some sense of empowerment, but I think it both lifts up the idea that we need these communities, we need this social support. You know, nothing is stronger in my book than a religion to get you to have these super invested communities. I've never lived anywhere in my life, from Boston to Baltimore, where my neighbors would bring me a meal if I got sick or hurt. I never lived anywhere in my life where people would give up 2 years of their life and pay to move to a foreign country at 19 and 21, or now 19 and 18, to just go talk about what they believe. You know, so Mormonism gives you this sense of community in which you're willing to sacrifice these enormous things to have that sense of community, but you get something from it too, which is this connection and this community. And so understanding the physiology and the evolution makes us take more seriously both how great it is, but also how painful it is if you leave, or if you're forced to leave, or if you're kicked out, or if you don't fit, if you're not right. So it's both a, you know, it's that double-edged sword where, like, I want to, you know, kind of shout from a pulpit to all the secular liberals about how important religion is to giving us that community, which is what we need in our modern world, inundated with all of these changes and all of this negativity. We actually need community more than we ever have, and we need it to be strong, and we need it to be, you know, really, really these tight-knit communities. And yet we're failing at that, and we denigrate these religions that have that. And yet at the same time, I definitely don't ever want to dismiss the pain of people who have been discriminated against by those groups and been kicked out. And I can tell you from my own personal experience that nothing was as devastating as having my world crumble, my entire worldview, my belief system, my past, my present, my future, my entire worldview crumbled, you know, in my belief failing. And it was the most pain I've ever experienced. And I continue to experience it. So, it's just that double-edged sword, you know, the positive and the negative that I think we need to talk about more.
Yeah, I really appreciate you with that segue, because I think that it's so important. I try so hard to keep this podcast, for example, somewhat balanced. And, you know, working as a mental health professional, obviously I see a lot of the issues, right, that come up from our culture and our doctrine, even our belief systems. You know, some, I just see how it can be so harmful, like you said, and painful for many of our members to grapple with these questions and issues and transitions and relationships as they do some of these things. And but it's never my intent to come across as like, oh, you know, Mormonism is just this really bad thing that we need to, it is, like you're saying, it's very double-edged. And I feel like the benefits, the reason why I created this podcast to maybe bring out some of the stories around some of the pain that we have within our communities and how we manage it, is because I think there's already plenty of airtime for all the positives. And we get that a lot at church, we get that at general conference, we get that in our, you know, like we said, that's what's allowed to be talked about. And so I just hope that this can be a venue where we can talk about some of these things that people really struggle with, without it necessarily becoming this negative, I guess, venue that would bring people down. Is that, maybe that's too much to ask for. I don't know.
I think we need that. I mean, I listened to Bill Maher and I think, what? Like, no, we can't, that can't be the future of how we talk about religion. Even if you're, you know, secular or atheist, that just can't be the future. And then I see the religious violence and I'm like, that can't be the future either. And I think we just are struggling, and this is beyond Mormonism, but also in our own community, we are struggling to figure out a way to do it better without severing how we've been doing it, which is how we find our value. You know, that's what makes us, you know, is that we're unchanging, that we have this, you know, this tradition, and that people get a lot of comfort from this idea, that we won't be swayed by the local, you know, traditions or something. And so it's everyone on the planet today is facing this balance between, change and tradition, you know, and you could argue that's always the case in culture, but I think it is reaching ahead as we try to approach these issues. Think about war, you know, in the last 50 years, it's heavily, heavily changed the art of war, the violence, the aspect of religion and ideology, you know, including women's issues. So in the next 50 years, these are going to be topics that change the face of national politics, you know, that change the face of the global population. Are women going to see equality in the world religion? That will change the face of 7 billion people for women to have a role in ecclesiastical leadership, not even talking about a role in financial decision making and what that would do to shift the way we spend money. So these issues in my mind, why I take it so seriously and why I think they're so important, what you're doing is so critical, is we need people who can diplomatically speak about this stuff from a middle perspective and kind of explain what's at stake on both sides.
Okay, so with that, why don't you give us a quick introduction into what is Ordained Women? What is LDS Wave?
Okay, I'd be happy to. So I think that a lot of people recently have heard about Ordained Women. And so I'd like to start just a little bit earlier. I know that I came to the scene around 2005. Which is still very late. I mean, we had feminist Mormon resistance, which is what I want to call it, but you can call it anything. I just tried to put an amalgam there. You know, throughout, you could argue the early church, you know, with a lot of polygamy actually freed up women to do roles that they hadn't done previously, because they weren't in the home. They had other wives to help them raise their children. So they were able to, you know, build hospitals and have a magazine and create a granary and do all of these amazing things. And we see, as the church became more correlated, we begin to see women kind of fighting back, pushing back from that correlation a little bit. And in 1974 is when Exponent, or the Women's Exponent Literary Magazine began. And we begin to see, you know, women, feminist Mormons kind of taking up some kind of advocacy roles. And at the time it was literary, and we saw a lot of that happening for decades. But we begin to see with Sonia Johnson, every 10 years, there's a woman being excommunicated for dissidents. We see, you know, after the ERA, we mobilized in a political way that we hadn't seen in that whole century, basically, the church mobilized since, you know, the Smoot trials, basically. So 1982 became a huge thing for Mormons, where they began to be on a public action in a way we hadn't seen. We see publicly Sonia Johnson being excommunicated, and we see this backlash, right? Same thing happened, you know, 1993. We see the Margaret Tuscany, we see September 6th. We see this enormous backlash, and then we see women hiding. And what happens as we get, sorry, that was 1993 is September 6th, 2003 is Margaret Tuscany. And then we get into 2013, and this is where we get the modern generation, right, with the Kate Kelly and the John DeLynn. And I think what we're seeing is both a consistent pattern, you know, and we see this undulation in any type of religious situation where you'll have kind of an advance of patriarchal authority, and then people kind of push back on that, and we see this allowance for dissidents, and then when that gets too far, we see the patriarchal authority push back down, and we see this undulation throughout time and throughout religions. But what's fascinating about this modern incarnation, and it gets us back to the information age too, is for the first time, and you could ask, you know, Margaret this, but for the first time we actually see these enormous communities rallying around these excommunicated members. And what happens in the journals of Sonia Johnson in September 6th and Margaret is, once they got excommunicated, they lost their community. They felt alone. They felt rejected. They didn't have anyone to go to. They didn't have, you know, online campaigns of thousands of people friending them and saying, we support you and we're with you. And so what's happening now is just completely different, even though it's following after the pattern that we've always seen. It's this fascinating world in Mormonism where we have these post-Mormon communities of support, where I know places, I'm going to speak in Arizona next week, and there's this Arizona Mormon Stories post-Mormon community where they, you know, it's like a ward. They get together every Sunday, sometimes more. They like help raise each other's kids. They bring meals after babies. It's a thing we've never seen before. And so I got a little off track, but I do think kind of viewing activism and viewing change, we have to look at it from this new lens, which alters the costs and consequences of action. And this modern generation is being raised, seeing women kind of fight back and advocate for themselves, and not necessarily get punished. I mean, they have seen some examples, but they've also seen examples where they are allowed to raise their voice. And I think that raises a whole generation. I know that I see young girls talk about female ordination without, you know, sweating from their armpits. Whereas when I was growing up, even when we started WAVE in 2010, we were terrified. If someone asked us about ordination, we immediately said, no, we're not pushing for that. We just want cultural changes in the church. That's all we want. And at the time, in 2010, that was pushing buttons. I got called into my bishop, my stake president. I got a lot of pushback from women in my ward. And all we wanted was cultural changes. Nothing doctrinally, just things we can make in our local wards, which is exactly the stance the church currently has. But 5 years ago, that was radical.
Can you give examples of what you're referring to?
Cultural changes? Yeah, we created lists of stuff like that. I actually wrote a list called I Feel Unequal One. And so it's things like you know, we got kind of lampooned for saying, you know, there should be changing tables in the men's room, you know, something as silly as that, to having, you know, Relief Society presidencies on the High Council rotation. Why not? Why aren't we hearing from female leaders too? You know, why don't we have a female Sunday school president, or that's not even allowed? Why are the men's and women's budgets so different? They should be the same. You know, just these little things to big things, you know, of why are women having to express sexual indiscretions to men? You know, why are young girls put through that? That should not be allowed. And so we just created these lists of how can we change these little things, and even cultural things. And you know, at the time that was just very radical. We were terrified. The board members thought we would get excommunicated. We were coming from generations of Mormon feminists who expressed their views through literary magazines, and that was advocacy. And so for us to actually want to go out and do demonstrations or do actions or like make changes, you know, there was older feminists like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. We got a lot of pushback. And then here we go, you know, 5 years even further into the future, and we see even a more radical move of like a direct action and even more pushback, but even more change. And so, you know, I think that it's a fascinating thing for me, as a participant, having been involved in all of the protests and the actions and the petitions and the, you know, people seem to think, oh, well, I don't mind that they're doing change, ordained women, but they're doing it the wrong way. And I love when someone says that, because I'm like, okay, well, do you know the 37 other things we've done in the last 10 years? And no one knows. No one knows that we've done a White Roses campaign, that we've done All Are Like Unto God petitions, that we've done Women Who Know, that we've done, and they don't know all the like appropriate ways we've tried to advocate for change, because they just didn't make as much of a splash. So I think that the diversity of the Mormon feminist resistance movement, or whatever you want to call the community, needs to be talked about in its whole, because there's been so many offshoots and varieties and attempts, and we don't all get along. And behind the scenes, we support and love each other, but we, not everyone wants ordination. Not everyone wants a male priesthood line. People want a female priesthood line. Some people, you know, don't care at all about that. They just want, you know, administrative equality. They don't care about ecclesiastical equality, you know? So there's all of this diversity in women, especially promulgated in the last decade or so. So I have to like talk about it in its breadth, just because it often gets lost.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus Savior, pilot me. Unknown ways before me roll, hiding rock and treacherous shore, chart and compass came from thee, Jesus Savior, pilot me. Child, thou canst hush Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Boisterous way,
boisterous way.
Obey thy will,
obey thy will.
When thou say, Sovereign of the sea, Jesus, Savior, pilot me. When at last fear not, I will pilot thee.
Twixt me and the peaceful rest.
Then while leaning on my breast, may I hear.